everyone. Are there any questions? Okay. So, last time I was talking about statistics in the example of a biased random coin. And here there was one parameter in the model, the probability of heads. And I was analyzing a situation where 100 flips had been done. That's the experiment or the data. And 64 heads resulted. And according to one way of analyzing this, the result is that the result of a frequentist analysis is that the 95% confidence interval on the unknown parameter theta was worked out to be 0.538 to 0.734. And the meaning of this is if someone asks you what it means, you can say, well, if theta were outside of this range, if it were, say, 0.537, then the probability in a simulated experiment of getting this result is very small. It's less than 2.5%. So in frequentist analysis, the meaning of a confidence interval is always assigned by, always determined by thresholding a p-value, where a p-value means the probability of getting a given result as a statistical fluke. P-value is probability of statistical fluke. Now, it said that there were two main schools of thought in statistics. One of them is frequentist analysis, and the other term you'll hear is Bayesian analysis. So, I want to explain what Bayesian analysis means in the context of this simple example. So Bayesian analysis, I'm going to say it's a four-step process. I'm going to end up calculating the 95% confidence interval on this parameter, and I'll get slightly different numbers because frequentist and Bayesian analysis are not strictly equivalent. So four steps. Step one is to assign a prior p of theta. The philosophy of Bayesian analysis is that I have some probability distribution on theta, the prior, before I make the measurement, and then I update it after I make the measurement to get something called a posterior. So this is a prior PDF p of theta. So this is just a choice. And I'm going to choose the prior to be uniform. So I'll choose it to be 1 if theta is between 0 and 1, and 0 otherwise. So before I look at the outcome of the experiment, I say as my prior PDF that all values are of theta are equally likely. When thinking about statistics, the following comment may be helpful, at least I find it helpful, that the word probability can mean two different things. Sometimes we use the word probability to mean the frequency of occurrence in a repeated experiment. And sometimes we use the word probability to mean degree of belief. For example, if you're thinking about flipping a biased coin with some known theta, and thinking about what possible outcomes will result, the probability distribution on those outcomes, you're using the word probability to mean frequency of occurrence. But if you're sitting on a jury and saying, I think in light of all the evidence I've heard that the probability that the defendant did it is 60%, then you're using the word probability to mean degree of belief. If you think about it, those are two slightly different concepts, but we use the same word for both. In this case, we're using, for this Bayesian prior, this is a probability distribution where probability means degree of belief. Before I take the measurement, I believe that all values are equally likely. All right. Then I compute the second step in this four-step process is I compute the conditional probability. And this time I mean probability in the sense of frequency of occurrence in a repeated experiment. So this is the probability, the conditional probability give these numbers names. Let's say n equals 100 flips and k equals 64 heads. So what I actually want here is k of theta. The probability of a given outcome. In this example, the outcome of the experiment is just one number, k. Given theta, which is the unknown bottle parameter, you guys have seen this notation before, right? In general, in statistics, the notation, I'll put it on a separate board. P of x bar y means the probability of x given y. So in this context, it means given an assumed value of theta, what's the probability of getting a particular specified value of k? Now, this is something that we wrote down before. The probability of getting k coin flips out of n is n choose k times theta to the k. So 1 minus theta to the n minus k. Because if you imagine a particular sequence of heads and tails, if you imagine listing the outcome of the flips, then the probability of getting a particular sequence with k heads and n minus k tails is given by multiplying together the chain of probabilities. There are k factors of theta and n minus k factors of 1 minus theta. And the binomial coefficient n choose k is just the number of such strings that have heads and tails that have a total of k heads and n minus k tails. OK. And then you apply Bayes' theorem to get the posterior. Bayes' theorem to get the posterior . So this is a theorem that you can prove, and I'll give the proof later. That says that if I take the measurement, so what I've written here is the probability of getting a particular outcome given a model parameter theta. And there's a theorem that lets me flip it around and say if I observe a particular outcome k, then my updated probability distribution or degree of belief on the parameter theta is just given by, this theorem is so intuitive to apply, it's easy to apply it without realizing that you're invoking a theorem. Is given by this. I just multiply the prior by the probability of getting the outcome, and then divide by whatever normalizing constant makes the integral come out equal to 1. Every probability distribution has to have the property that its integral is 1. When we do calculations, usually we just forget about this denominator and calculate with the proportional to sign. And just remember that at the end, we have to put in whatever normalizing constant makes the integral equal to 1. So in this case, after I do my experiment and observe my 64 heads, then I get this. I'll put the actual values in. I just took the conditional likelihood, and then I put in the prior, which I'll put in as a factor of 1, just to denote it explicitly. And then I'm supposed to remember that I divide by whatever normalizing constant makes the integral over theta from 0 to 1 come out equal to 1. And this is a function that you can plot. If you were to plot it, you would find some it would peak at theta equals 0.64. And it would have some width, which is the confidence interval that we're looking for. And the integral under the curve would be 1. So this curve represents, if before the experiment all values of theta were equally likely, this represents my probability distribution. This is the posterior. Once I look at the outcome of the experiment and saw the 64 heads. And then confidence regions, to assign confidence regions based on this posterior. Put this on another board. So there's actually the posterior is supposed to tell you everything that you need to know. Gives you the full probability distribution on one or more parameters that you're interested in. And there are actually multiple prescriptions for assigning the confidence region. In many variables, things can get a little confusing. But in one variable, I think there's only one sensible prescription, which is to say that what I'm going to do is integrate the what I just said is not true. I think there's actually a couple of sensible prescriptions in 1D, but the simplest one, the one that I'll use, is to say, well, let me just integrate until the total accumulated probability reaches some threshold, and I'll take that threshold to be 0.25. And 0.025 on this side. So let me write that out. I'm going to say, I did this calculation. I found that I took this curve. I just put this formula into Python. And I asked Python, how far do I integrate before I get 2.5% of the total area under the curve? And the number that I got was 0.542. And 0.727. So what those numbers represent in this example, I found that if I integrated to 0.542, integrated the posterior likelihood, that I got 0.025. And that if I integrated from 0.727 to 1, then I got, also got 0.25. So you get okay, and that's how Bayesian statistics works in this simple example. So the philosophy of Bayesian statistics is that everything in the world is described by a probability distribution. Before I take this measurement, I had some prior, like the betting odds that I would give for the coins, theta being in certain ranges. And then when I get more information, I update my probability distribution for theta. If I did another experiment and got more information, then I would multiply in that conditional likelihood to update the posterior again. They give slightly different answers. The frequentist and Bayesian analysis give consistent but slightly different answers. And both frameworks are internally consistent, but just differ slightly in what they mean by a confidence interval. In the frequentist approach, the confidence interval always means the odds of getting the observed result as a statistical fluke. And the Bayesian confidence interval represents betting odds. It would say that what this interval means is that I would accept a 20 to 1 bet that the value of theta is somewhere in this range after seeing the outcome of the experiment. The betting odds for it are one way to think about degree of belief. So you might think that there's not really a whole lot of difference between the two approaches, but there is, in fact, kind of a holy war in the statistics community between the two camps, with people writing like nasty papers back and forth. I personally think that both frameworks are useful, and I do use both of them depending on what I'm doing. In this example, I actually think I like the frequentist analysis a little bit better in this simple example. Because if you had to explain to someone who didn't know any statistics what the confidence interval means, then I think the story is simpler. You just say, well, I know theta can't be less than this, because if it were, I can compute the probability of getting this number, and it's small. And in the Bayesian analysis, you have to tell this more complicated story. You say, well, I have this philosophy that everything in the world is described by a probability distribution. And when I get data, I update to get a new distribution. And that's what I did. And then I integrated. More complicated story. However, I would say most of the time, so I really don't personally choose a side, but if I had to choose a side, most of the time I find Bayesian statistics to be a little more useful. Like by default, I would tend to use Bayesian statistics. It's just kind of a unifying, kind of a simple conceptual framework where you just keep updating probabilities in terms of each other. And it just tends to be simpler to think about in complicated examples. There are also more like mathematical tools for exploring these probability distributions in large numbers of dimensions. And so Bayesian statistics tends to be computationally easier. So I don't want to keep redoing. I think it's fun and interesting to talk about these two statistical camps a little bit. But I don't want to keep redoing every example in two different ways, frequentist and Bayesian. So I just decided to make a choice. And for the rest of the examples, I'm just going to do Bayesian only. In some of the homeworks, for example, the homework that just went up on the wiki, I may ask you to reproduce, I may derive some results in a Bayesian way in lecture, and then ask you to redo them in a frequentist way. But in the lecture, I'll just do Bayesian statistics from now on. One little comment, you know, in Bayesian statistics, the one thing that I don't like about it is that the results depend on the choice of prior. If I had chosen a different prior in this example, like if I had downweighted extreme values of theta and made it peak at 0.5 or something, it would affect the shape of this curve, and it would affect the confidence intervals. So the results are prior dependent, but a rule of thumb is that if the data are highly constraining, if the posterior matters more in determining the shape than the prior, then the results won't depend on the choice of prior very much. But it can be an important thing to check. Okay. So next I want to talk about example two, which is less of a toy example and more representative of the sorts of things that we do in cosmology. So I want to talk about the problem of fitting a straight line through some points with error bars. So the setup is that I have some measurements with error bars And I want to find the best fit line that goes through the points. It's important when I work out the details that there are error bars in the y direction, but not in the x direction. So the x's where I make the measurements are non-random, but the y's that I get have some statistical random noise. So the setup will be that I have points x, I, y, I. And I'm going to assume that each y has a Gaussian error. Formally, I assume that the difference between the measurement and the fit is a Gaussian random variable with some width. There's a Gaussian error with variance sigma I squared. There's an I here, an index, so the error bars are allowed to have different sizes. Okay. I'm going to analyze this example in the Bayesian context. So the A and the B are the model parameters that I want to constrain, and this is my data. And I'm going to derive the posterior distribution in the AB plane. By the way, sometimes I'll say likelihood, posterior likelihood. Generally in statistics, as far as I can tell, the word likelihood is just a synonym for PDF, or probability distribution function. But people tend to say it more when they're doing Bayesian statistics, when they're talking about prior likelihoods or posterior likelihoods. Statistics seems to have a lot of redundant terminology to me, but I always wonder if maybe as a physicist I'm abusing the terminology, and if there's some nuance that I don't understand. But as far as I can tell, these mean the same thing. Okay. So let's define some matrix notation. It'll be convenient to use some 2x2 matrices. So 2x2 matrix notation. And one advantage of this matrix notation is that all the formulas that I will write down will generalize to the case where there are n parameters instead of 2. You just have n by n matrices. So I'm going to define the parameter theta to theta 1 is a two-component vector where theta 1 is A and theta 2 is B. So these are my model parameters. And I'll define F to be the pair of functions x and 1, so that the equation of the curve that I'm trying to fit through the points is just the sum of theta A. Let me use A's. I decided I was going to use letters A and B for indices in this two-component space, and indices IJ for indices in this n-component space. Okay. Let's do this four-step Bayesian analysis. Same problem as last time. So, the first step is to choose a prior, and this is just a choice, but I'm going to take the uniform prior on my parameter vector theta. Uniform prior in the theta plane. By the way, it's okay if the normalization of the prior is unspecified, because I'm going to end up dividing out the normalization in the end anyway. Just as a comment, overall constants never matter in Bayesian analysis. This binomial coefficient was a complication that didn't matter in the end. It didn't affect the shape of this curve. More generally, any factor in the likelihood that depends on the data, that would be k here, but not the model, that theta, can be dropped. So the normalization of the prior doesn't matter, and a non-normalizable prior is also OK. In this case, the prior extends over the whole theta plane. But that's fine, as long as when you multiply in this conditional probability to get the posterior, you end up getting something normalizable. So step one was trivial. Step two is to write down the conditional probability of the data given the model. And in this example, data means the observed y values. Those are the results of the experiment. And the model is theta, the parameters of the curve that is supposed to fit the points. So how can we write down that likelihood? Well, if I have a model, if I have a assumed value or a trial value for this line, then what is the probability of getting a certain set of yi's? Well, each yi is supposed to be an independent Gaussian random variable centered on the line. So its probability distribution would be a one-dimensional Gaussian with mean given by the value of the line and variance given by that number sigma squared. So the probability of getting a certain an individual y is just the Gaussian PDF that tells you the probability of getting y. Write this down. I've just written down the Gaussian PDF, or that is to say the probability, the PDF for y, given that the mean is the value of the curve at, oh, sorry, this should have been xi. And the variance is sigma squared. And I have one such factor. I want the probability of getting all the yi's, so I would multiply this over I. I'll simplify this. Let me leave it in this form and simplify it in the next step.
There's a square in the exponential.
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, thanks. That should have been squared. And then let's apply Bayes' theorem. Get the posterior. And usually we'll want to simplify it. So, because I'm multiplying the uniform prior, I just multiply these factors together. So I just have the same thing. I'm just writing it out again. I interpret it differently. Instead of interpreting it as a probability distribution on the y's, I'm interpreting it as a probability distribution on the thetas. And there's also a proportional to here, since I need to, when I reinterpret which variables it's a probability distribution in, the normalizing constant will be different. I've dropped, by the way, because I'm now computing up to an overall constant, I've dropped this factor. This factor is constant in the thetas, so I can drop it. Okay. No. If I'm thinking of this as a probability distribution in theta, there are some simplifications that make sense. I'm going to simplify this by completing the square. So, sorry, I don't mean completing the square. I just mean multiplying out the square. So let me do that. And then, let's see. One thing that I can do here is just get rid of this term. Why can I get rid of it? Yeah, exactly. It's independent of theta. So here, if I'm thinking about it as a probability distribution in the thetas, then as far as the thetas are concerned, this is an overall constant that I can drop. If I were thinking about it as a probability distribution in the y's, then it would not be considered a constant, and I wouldn't be able to drop it. So I'm going to drop that term. And then I'm just going to use some matrix notation for the remaining terms, just to make the theta dependence a little easier to think about. So I decided to write it this way. Minus 1 half theta transpose f theta plus theta transpose v. Where F is the 2x2 matrix, and V is a 2-component vector. So viewed as a probability distribution in the theta plane, what type of probability distribution is this? Well, I have an x, and I have something which is quadratic inside the x, quadratic in the variables. This is an example of a Gaussian distribution, multivariate Gaussian. If you want to write it in the strictly kosher if you want to write it in like a strictly kosher, as a strictly kosher Gaussian PDF, you can complete the square inside the exponential to write it this way. And there's a term, if I were to complete the square, there's a term that I have to bring out that looks like this. But that's, so let me say that that term was there, but I got to get rid of it because it's independent of theta. And in this form, you can see that this is a Gaussian with mean. F inverse V and covariance. In the multivariate Gaussian PDF, the mean is whatever sits inside of the parentheses here that's subtracted from the thetas. And the matrix that sits in here was the inverse covariance of the PDF. So the covariance is F inverse. So
Oh, let me raise this board.
Hmm. Oh, this, I boxed myself into a board raising corner. I'm gonna have to just. Let me just leave this here and continue on the other side. So in the theta plane, the posterior would look something like this. There would be a mean, a point in this plane, which is F inverse V. And the errors would be, because the posterior is Gaussian, the errors would be ellipses. And the covariance is given by F inverse. The covariance matrix of the that describes the ellipses is given by F inverse. And what we've just derived is a standard thing that you can find in statistics textbooks. I started with a set of points that I was trying to fit. And it could have been an n-component fit as long as it was a linear fit in the sense that the coefficients that I was trying to fit were just coefficients in front of some fixed functions of x. And provided that the errors on the original measurements are Gaussian, then there's some non-trivial formulas that you plug into. In a statistics package, like there are statistics packages where you specify points with error bars and press a button and it'll fit a line or whatever curve you want. And it's using formulas like these. So you plug into these formulas and get you know, this matrix and this vector. And then we showed that the when you work out the posterior, that in terms of those quantities, the best fit is given by F inverse V. And the parameters of the fit have some complicated correlations. They have a covariance matrix that doesn't have to be diagonal. They can be correlated. But we computed that matrix, so we know everything that we need to know. The matrix F here is a specific example of something called a Fisher matrix, which in this example, the Fisher matrix just meant inverse covariance matrix of the posterior. And, but it has a more general definition that applies to non-Gaussian posteriors that I'll give in a minute. But that's pretty close to the spirit of it in general, is it's the inverse covariance matrix of a set of model parameters after making a measurement. Now, one little comment that I'll make in this example. Suppose that you were to just shift the coordinate system, the value of x, where you take the measurements and reanalyze the data. So instead of analyzing the data in this in these coordinates, I'll use a coordinate system with a different origin. Call that x prime. Then we'll redefine the parameters. I guess under that shift, if I shift the origin by delta x, then the value of a stays the same. So if x prime is x, I think I would want to say minus delta x. And but b shifts by a delta x. If you think about what it does to this ellipse, I guess I didn't say what the axes were going to be, but I want this one to be A and this one to be B. Is that as I move the, if I repeat the analysis with different coordinate systems, the error ellipse moves around. If I imagine starting with an x that's roughly centered on the points and then I move it more and more to the right, I'll get ellipses that get more and more sheared out. In general, it's true that just like when we talked about the n-dimensional multivariate Gaussian. We could diagonalize the covariance matrix. Whether or not this ellipse has a tilt or a correlation, it's just sort of a function of the basis in which you view the matrix, not the matrix itself. And likewise, in general, we can always find variables. We can change variables on the model space to make the ellipse look very different. In particular, sometimes in statistics, we talk about the question of whether there's a parameter degeneracy. Like if the ellipse looked like this, we might say that the two parameters are very degenerate in that you can vary one against the other and still be consistent for a long way and still be consistent with the data. So whether or not there's a degeneracy in the sense that you have a long, skinny ellipse is really just a statement about the variables in which you've analyzed the problem. In this example, you can show that there's a unique choice of origin, which makes the correlation zero, which makes the ellipse lined up with the axes. So this is a comment that I'll return to in more generality later. Okay. We completely crushed the curve fitting problem. Let's talk about the abstract definition of the Fisher matrix. The setup is that we imagine that you have a model space with some parameters theta, and you have some data d representing the outcome of a measurement. So in our first example of the biased random coin, there was a single model parameter, which was the probability of heads. And the data was a single number. We called it k, the number of heads. In the curve fitting example, theta was a two-component thing, and the data was the set of y values, yi. I want to distinguish between, just to introduce a little more statistical context. In general, in statistics, we're always doing one of three things. Either simulation, which means given a model, how do I simulate an experiment? In the examples we've talked about, this is pretty trivial. For example, in the curve fitting case, if you had a straight line, you would generate these points by just taking the location, the y values along the line and adding some Gaussian random errors. Then there's analysis, which is what we've been talking about so far. So in both of these examples, we were thinking about the question, given the outcome of an experiment, what are the constraints on the model parameters? And thirdly, there's forecasting, where I say, given a fiducial model, what constraints can I expect to get call it theta fid. What constraints will I get? For a typical realization of the data. For example, you might, maybe you haven't done a CMB experiment yet, you don't have data, but you want to know what constraints on some on the cosmological parameters you expect to get when you do after you do the experiment. So there's a difference between analysis and forecasting. Analysis requires a realization of the data, but no preferred model. Whereas forecasting requires a preferred model that will define what typical means, but no realization of the data. And I want to switch gears a little bit from talking about analysis to talking about forecasting. And the Fisher matrix, whose general definition I'll give in a minute, is a tool for forecasting. It also always comes up as some sort of intermediate quantity when you're doing analysis. You might notice in this curve fitting example that the matrix F here didn't depend on the outcome of the experiment. It didn't depend on the y's, whereas V did. So in this example, even if I hadn't done the experiment yet, even if I didn't have y's, I would still be able to predict in advance what covariance F inverse I would expect to get when I do the experiment. I just wouldn't know what central point to use, of course. Okay. So to define the Fisher matrix abstractly, I want to state some assumptions. First, I want to assume that, so let me say first that this is, I'm thinking about forecasting, where I have a theta in mind, but no data. So I'm going to assume, the first assumption that I am going to make is that when I do have data, when I do get data, that the posterior of theta given d will be Gaussian. And this is an interesting assumption to think about. In both of these examples, it's a good approximation. Well, actually, in the curve fitting example, it's perfect. We found that the posterior was exactly Gaussian. In the coin flipping example, it was not. I still have the posterior on the board. That's not a Gaussian. That's not of the form e to the quadratic. But it is the case, you can check, that in the coin flipping example, as the number of flips n gets large, it Gaussianizes. I don't actually know of any sort of general theorem that defines conditions under which this is a good approximation. Empirically, it's often a good approximation. But I don't know of any general reason why it would be, actually. Now, there's the central limit theorem. It might remind you of the central limit theorem. But the central limit theorem is the statement about probability in the sense of frequency of occurrence in a situation where you're averaging together many things. And that doesn't appear to apply to posteriors. And I don't see any reason why it would apply here. And indeed, in cosmology, there are situations where it's actually not a good approximation. Even though many modes of the CMB are summed over when determining the posterior. So I don't think this is something that you should think of as guaranteed to be true, but something that you just have to think about when you're using this formalism. Now, an equivalent way of stating this is to say that the second derivative of the log, the matrix of second derivatives, is constant in theta. If you think about it for a minute, you'll see why these statements are equivalent. Remember, Gaussian just means that the PDF is an X, and whatever sits inside the X is a quadratic. Well, the log just removes the X, and then for any function of the thetas, the matrix of second derivatives is constant in theta, or equivalently, I could have said that all the third derivatives were zero. If and only if the function being differentiated is a quadratic polynomial. Okay. Now, it doesn't have to be constant in the data. But what I might do, so this might be, this matrix of second derivatives might be not assumed constant in D. So this matrix of second derivatives is encoding the covariance of the assumed Gaussian posterior. But depending on which realization of the data I get, I might get a different matrix. So for forecasting, where I don't have a realization of the data yet, what would make sense is to average it over realizations of the data. That is the definition of the Fisher matrix, the abstract definition of the Fisher matrix in any model space. So the notation, this notation means expectation value of over realizations of the data D assuming fiducial model parameters that's fairly easy to define. And we could revisit the definition in these two examples. In example two, you can check that this matrix works out to be the matrix F that we defined before. In example one, the biased coin, I left it as a homework problem in the problem set to compute the Fisher matrix there. In that example, there's only one parameter, theta. So the Fisher matrix is a 1x1 matrix, or just a scalar F. In order to show you how it works, I only have 5 minutes, but I think that's actually, well, I have 5 minutes left. I was going to show you an example three, which is an interesting calculation of this matrix. I don't think I can do example three in 5 minutes, so why don't we just, and I don't want to stop in the middle of a calculation, so why don't we just stop for today, and we'll pick up tomorrow with more examples of how to compute this matrix and what it means in those examples.
So one question, so we said that we didn't have data, but to get the Fisher matrix, we used a fiducial model to generate possible data with that calculate the Fisher matrix?
Yeah, right. So to do analysis, you need to have data. But you don't need to have a preferred model in mind. You end up getting some computing, some posterior, which tells you the probability of every model, and you don't need to specify a model in advance. I guess you do need a prior. The forecasting works the opposite way. I don't need to have any preferred realization of the data, but I do need to have a fiducial model. This matrix that I get can be different depending on which fiducial model you use. In other words, this matrix is actually a function of the model parameters. It's usually a slowly varying function, but it does depend weakly on which fiducial model is assumed. The choice of the dependence on the fiducial model is hidden in this expectation value. Because I take the expectation value over realizations of the data with that fiducial model. Oh, I guess it's also here, actually. You also evaluate here. For example, in the in the case of the biased random coin, it's a problem in the problem set to show that the Fisher matrix is given by this number. In this example, and this will be clearer when I talk about the Fisher matrix more tomorrow, what the theta dependence means is that, so generally speaking, if I have a biased random coin, and I flip it many times, the statistical error on theta goes down as I take more flips. The Fisher matrix is getting larger. But there's also an effect where let me think about which way this goes. This formula is saying that if I'm at the edge, so if I have a coin with whose probability theta is very close to zero, then I get a smaller error on theta after 100 flips than I would if the probability was 0.5. I think that actually makes some intuitive sense. If you had a coin, a 50-50 coin, and you flipped it 100 times and got 55 heads, you might say, I think theta is somewhere between 0.4 and 0.6. But if I flipped it 100 times and got all heads, or all tails, then I might be comfortable saying that the statistical error is less than 0.02, say. My error bar is lower if the probability is extreme. Okay. Any more questions? Okay.